exciting. Hopefully we can do this on a regular basis. We try to start off doing it once a month, and hopefully you'll find it engaging. It's good to see people during the daytime, not only at nighttime. So this is sort of like a four-part lecture series on different controversies of early Zionism. And today's goal is to discuss the background of the Heter Shemitah controversy, and specifically the evolution of the controversy from the earliest days in 1888 and 1889 to the time when Rav Kook was the chief rabbi of Yafo in 1909 and 1910. It's going to be mostly history, a little bit of halacha, but mostly history, just to see how it essentially evolved. I'm sorry? Okay. The Heter Mechira, when it comes to Shemitah, is that you're not allowed to work every 7 years, you're not allowed to work on the land in Israel, but it was a very desperate situation, as we'll discuss, for farmers who basically, their only source of income is farming the land, and how did they try to get around that? So the Jews, basically, a little bit of history, the Jews are living in Israel, which was in Eretz Yisrael, which is under the Ottoman rule since 1517. The Ottomans conquered Constantinople in 1453, and from 1517 it was known as this Islamic state. There's a small Jewish population in Eretz Yisrael until the 1500s. After the Spanish expulsion, so many Sephardim are moving to Eretz Yisrael. What communities are they probably living in mostly? Yerushalayim, and another popular one? Tzfat. Okay, good. So these are Sephardim who are living there. For example, the author of the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Cairo was living in Tzfat at the time, in the 1500s. In the 1700s, who comes to Eretz Yisrael? What? Well, not himself, but his students of the Vilna Gaon come, and also some students of the Baal Shem Tov. They agree on something, okay? So the students of the Baal Shem Tov, students of the Vilna Gaon, arrive in Eretz Yisrael, and they settle in four holy cities, Tzfat, Tveria, Hebron, and Yerushalayim. And they form what's known as the Yishuv HaYashad. This is called the old settlement. This was not a self-sufficient community. The charity of, I'm sure you've heard of this charity, Ramir Balhanes, right? I know, we lose a lot of things. They make a lot of money, I don't know. Okay, so it happens in my house. So the charity of Ramir Balhanes serves as a vehicle of financial support for much of the Yishuv HaYashan. In Yerushalayim, everyone lived inside walls because it was dangerous outside. There was overcrowding. There was unsanitary conditions. Now, we fast forward to the 1850s, and Moses Montefiore builds the agricultural settlements of Yamin Moshe and Mishkanot Shananim in Yerushalayim. That's the famous historic windmill. By 1880... approximately 25,000 Jews are living in Eretz Yisrael, almost 17,000 living in Yerushalayim. The total Palestinian population the Arab population is 250,000. So we have about 10%. Okay? Now, what happens in 1881, the pogroms begin in Russia. Many of them realize that the solution of emancipation lay outside Russia. Before 1881, and this is probably going to speak more about this in my next lecture, but before 1881, Zionism was based primarily on religious messianic hopes. In other words, if you were a Zionist, for the most part, you were religious, you were messianic, because if you're secular, you think that the hope rests in whatever country you're living in. For the most part, after 1881, after the pogroms, many disillusioned, maskilim, secular Jews, like Moses Leib Lilienbaum, Peretz Smolenskin, joined the Chibat Zion movement, which begins in the 1860s, and this association of secular thinkers changed the character of the movement. Initially, the Zionist movement was religious, but really from the 1880s, you have a lot of secular Jews who moved there. Yes?
Rishon LeZion was an Orthodox settlement, and it was founded by Jews who came convinced any more Orthodox Jews to leave Russia. So eventually, you know, the Tzion eventually became secret. But it still exists. It's like their version of Old Testament or
whatever. Right. Yeah. So we're gonna talk about some of them. Yep, 100%. We're gonna talk about some of them. There's been a shift because it happened to be that again you had this mass movement of many secular Jews who moved starting from that time. Now the goal of Chibat Zion was not political. The goal is simply to strengthen settlement in Eretz Yisrael and Aliyah. Okay, one of the reasons why they focus on settling the land, by the way, not political, is that the Russian government wouldn't allow political activity. So in other words, you could have an organization that strengthens Aliyah moving to Eretz Yisrael, but don't talk Zionism, don't talk politics. And there were a number of rabbis who were supportive of this, the Netziv, the Malbim, the Beis Halevi, Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer, or Shmuel Oliver. Okay, now, during this time, and you had, you always need a wealthy person to support. During this time, there was this wealthy individual, Baron Edmund de Rothschild, and he is involved in supporting the first settlements. His name's going to come up in our discussion. So he's supporting these first settlements. From 1881 to 1903, this is often referred to as the first Aliyah of the Chovei Tzion. About 1,500 Jews made Aliyah. This is prior to an organization called Nefesh B'Nefesh, it was many years prior, and many died of starvation and disease. Among those who went, I'm sure some of you have heard this name, Eliezer ben Yehuda, right? He brought back Hebrew, right? He left for Eretz Yisrael, he brought back Hebrew usage in Eretz Yisrael. There was a Bilu organization was formed in 1882, Beit Yaakov L'chuvan Elcha, that they said, there's nothing, we have to, the house of Yaakov, we have to make Aliyah, and this was taken from a verse in Yeshayahu. It did not include the last two words, Beit Yaakov L'chuvan Elcha, Ba'or Hashem. They didn't include the light of God, because they were just, we got to get up and go. They were secular, and they about this time, around this time, the 1880s, so Jews are establishing agricultural communities. And that now they are venturing outside the old city, right? The old Yishuv, the Yishuv Yishan Yerushalayim. And, you know, and basically, before 1881, there are small new outposts. Petach Tikva was established in 1878. But in 1881, with this first Aliyah, you have seven additional moshavot were established, and I have here on the handout that I had. You have again, it's a tall, it's not so clear. You have, as Howie mentioned, you have Rishon LeZion, 1882. You have Zichron Yaakov, 1882, that's up north. Right? You have Rosh Pina, even farther up north, northeast, 1882. You have Ekron, which is later to be known Maskeret. Where is Ekron? Ekron is 1884. That's a little bit south of Rishon LeZion, to the west of Yerushalayim. It was eventually named Maskeret Batya, in memory of Baron Rothschild's mother. There is Nes Tziona. Okay, Nes Tziona. Where is that? I'm not sure if I can find it here. But Nes Tziona was at Yesod HaMa'ala in 1883. And Gedera in 1887. Okay, so you have some of these, some of them are in the map here. These settlements were poor. These were, this is why, by the way, we're going to get into the Shemitah question now in the 1880s, because this is when you have these new settlements that are being established. The settlements are poor, they're sparsely populated, they're under development, there are no trees, believe it or not. There was a time before the JNF, there were no trees there. The Jews improved the land. Many trained at Mikvah Yisrael, which was the first Jewish agricultural school in Eretz Yisrael, established in 1870. They drained the Hula swamp apparently they planted a eucalyptus tree by accident, and apparently it worked. They bought land for development. They used Arabs, which improved the standard of living for them as well. And Jews thought that by employing Arabs, all problems will be solved. That's not our topic for today. But, okay. The first modern Shemitah was really 1882, but there wasn't a lot of conversation about that Shemitah. There wasn't a lot of halachic discourse because there were only a handful of Jewish farmers in Petach Tikva and Motza and Mikveh Yisrael. The farmers, for the most part, observed Shemitah. According to some responsa literature, there were some rabbanim who did allow people to sell their fields to a Gentile for Shemitah, arguing that if a Gentile non-Jew owns the land, then it's not subject to the rules of Shemitah. During that time, the malarial swamps caused the abandonment of the new settlements by most residents. So it really wasn't much of an issue. There are very few settlements. They tried to make it work, but even without Shemitah, it really wasn't working. The Shemitah issue arises in 1889. By this, again, this is pre-Rav Kook. People think Rav Kook is the one who established the heter, the heter mechira, the allowance to sell the land. This was pre-Rav Kook. Rav Kook comes later. We'll get to that in a bit. The Shemitah issue arises in 1889. There's a much larger Jewish agricultural presence there in Israel. And the problem is twofold. Number one, the farmers themselves. And also, the people needed the food. And many farmers would not survive, they claim. Many Jews, then also, who were thinking of making Aliyah, they're not going to make Aliyah. Right? If you find out that these first settlements fail, right, then no one's going to make Aliyah because this will be a failed experiment. Now, Baron Edmund de Rothschild, remember I mentioned him? He was the one who was supporting these settlements. And he meets with Rabbi Shmuel Salant. Rabbi Shmuel Salant is the chief rabbi, rabbi of the Ashkenazi community of Yerushalayim. And he meets him in April, okay, and May of 1888. So that's right, a few months before Shemitah is beginning, with September, October of 1888. So he meets with Shmuel Salant. And he reported afterwards that he planned to follow Rabbi Salant's directives, that all the settlements will observe the Shemitah year. Rabbi Salant said, you have to, this Eretz Yisrael, it's Israel, you have to observe Shemitah. And apparently, Baron Rothschild apparently was going to follow that. By October, however, he thought that, quote, idleness for so long a period would ruin most of his young settlements. Okay, so it's sort of like what he said. We have to talk about why he may have changed his opinion exactly, different theories about that. But he seemed to, practically, like it's a nice theory, you have to observe this halacha, but he sees it's going to result in the destruction of these settlements. So he sends three of his administrators of the settlements to Rav Shmuel Salant to ask, you know, can you reconsider? Is there any halachic solution? So Rabbi Salant thought about it, and he said no. Okay, so that didn't stop the Baron. The Baron then goes to the next Gadol, right, it's called Rabbi Shopping here. So he goes to the next Gadol Yerushalayim, Rav Yehoshua Leib Diskind, and Yehoshua Leib Diskind said no. But he was not deterred. Baron Rothschild, he was living in France at the time. He approaches Rav Tzadok Khan, who's the chief rabbi of Paris, to find a solution. So you have to understand, like now he's going to his own personal Rav. It's very different, right? You go to some gadol who doesn't have such a connection with you, who's in Yerushalayim. But, you know, your own rabbi, it's a little more difficult. I know from personal experience, okay? So it's a little more difficult, but still, this is a major thing. Shemitah is obviously a very serious issue. So Rav Tzadok Khan, what?
Are the prior rulings an open thing? Is everybody aware of the prior rulings?
They're aware. I'm saying there's not much of a discussion about what they know generally about Shemitah, but there's not much of a discussion. There's not a lot of.
He goes to his own rabbi. Is his own rabbi aware of the prior?
Yeah, I think so. Yes. So he turns. He turns to one of, well, he's sort of saying, like, they said no, but maybe there could be a creative way to, in other words, if someone says you can't do this, right, and so maybe find, not just simply say that they're wrong, but maybe it under this creative method, then maybe we can work. So in other words, these rabbis, right, you don't necessarily have to, we're going to see what happens, but you don't necessarily have to disagree. You could say, I cannot think of a solution. Oh, I have a solution, so maybe then maybe the first time might agree. But in any case, so Rav Tzadok Khan, he was a chief rabbi of Paris, but But the leading rabbis, of course, were in Eastern Europe at that time. So he goes to the namesake of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan of Ritz, Wayu. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary, but that wasn't his name. It was just Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. So he was the one who was approached. He was one of the Gedolim of Kovno, Lithuania. And he said that you could halachically sell the land to the Arabs, but, and this is a very important point, and dealing with a lot of hot button issues today, very important, he thought you can, but he was hesitant to be the sole authority to issue a definitive ruling. This reminds me, a number of years back, Mary Willick came to our community and spoke about the prenup, and Mary Willick said that he came up with a solution, you know, to deal with the Aguda issue by having everyone sign a prenup. This was a new type of document. And even though he felt he was comfortable, he wasn't going to roll it out unless he had other rabbis, some kind of consensus, other Gedolim who supported it. Very important. This was like this, the Shemitah issue is a major issue. And Rabbi Yisrael Khan's Spector, he was one of the Gedolim, but he felt that I still need other Rabbanim to back my decision. So Rav Shmuel Molliver, he was one of the early religious supporters of the Chovei Tzion movement, of the Zionist movement. He encouraged Rav Yitzchak Inspector to meet other rabbis. So he went to Warsaw, and he meets with Rav Yeshua Trunk of Kutno and Rav Shmuel Zandvil Klapfish, the chief judge of the Rabbinical Court of Warsaw, to try to agree to a halachic leniency to work for the field during Shemitah. So again, there's a debate, and I'm just going to go through it generally. There's a debate as to whether selling the land to a non-Jew removes the religious strictures of Shemitah. Because you could argue that only you're not allowed to work on your land, on the land of a Jew during the Shemitah year, or the fruit has Shemitah holiness status, status of holiness, if it's your land. But maybe if you sell the land to the non-Jew, there are actually two different questions. If you sell the land to the non-Jews, number one, maybe the fruit doesn't have holiness status of Shemitah. And number two, the two questions might be related, they might be different. And number two, maybe then also you can work on the land as well. There are two different issues. Number one, how you treat the fruit, and secondly, are you allowed to work on the land? Again, I'm going to try to give some basics about the halachic issues. It's not an in-depth analysis. I think when Rabbi Kahn, Ari Kahn came here, he said he gave like 20 shiurim. We only have about 40 more minutes. Okay, so said I want to deal with mostly the history here. But in any case, one of the points of contention is whether Shemitah nowadays is only rabbinic, which is the majority view of the Rishonim. Most rabbis hold that today Shemitah is only a rabbinic obligation, because Shemitah is only a Torah obligation when most Jews live in Israel, like Yovel. Yovel, the Jubilee year, every 50 years, there are certain rules about every 50 years. That clearly, the Torah says that only applies when the majority of Jews are living in Eretz Yisrael. And Shemitah seems, according to many Rishonim, most Rishonim, would only apply on a biblical level if most Jews are living in Israel. Maybe only with where they're supposed to be in their tribe. So the question is, if majority of Jews soon will live in Israel, so how does that impact the Shemitah conversation? That's an interesting question. But in any case, in the 1880s, there clearly were not a majority of Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, once you knock the prohibition down to a rabbinic prohibition, you have a lot more leeway in trying to come up with a solution. Just so you should know who the players are, the rabbinic players, the Ramban and the Rush, they hold that it's a Torah prohibition, so these are significant rabbis, but other Rishonim, like the Rambam, holds that it's only rabbinic nowadays. There's even an opinion that nowadays it's only a Midas Chasidus. It's like a Pius, that's the Meiri and the Balamor, it's only a Midas Chasidus to observe Shemitah nowadays. So again, that's a minority view, but in the rabbinic literature, so they throw that in. Like when you write a responsum, and you try to find reasons to say why it's permitted, they'll say, and by the way, according to these rabbis, it's this. And they try to have a whole bunch of reasons. But in any case, most rabbis hold that it's only rabbinic. Additionally, a central issue is whether non-Jewish ownership of land in Israel removes the land from the obligation of the mitzvahs relevant to the land. This is a debate between Rav Yosef Cairo, who was lenient, and other Rishon, and others, rabbis around his time, the Mabita, the Marid, who disagree. Okay, so in other words, a lot of rabbis essentially are willing to say the following. Number one, there's a major debate as to whether non-Jewish ownership removes the sanctity of Shemitah. And they're going to say that what? That since most rabbis hold that nowadays Shemitah is only rabbinic, so then we can rely on the more lenient position that since Shemitah is only rabbinic, if you sell to a non-Jew, then it's not a problem. That's the basic, you know, that's like a basic way of looking at this. And then they said there's also another issue, which is, can you sell the land to non-Jews? There's a Torah prohibition of lo techanim that you're not allowed to give land. The non-Jews hold in the land. You're not allowed to sell land to the non-Jews. The question is, does this only apply to idolaters? Does it apply to Arab, to non-idolaters? And it's funny because if you think about it, the reason of lo techanim, of not giving a hold you're not allowed to give land to the non-Jews, give them a hold on the land, is why? Because we want to live there. We don't want them to live there. But the whole reason why you're selling the land is why? To ensure that what? that this Aliyah experiment works. So it's actually interesting that the philosophy behind it, we're not selling it permanently. You're not selling it permanently, only selling it temporarily. So that was also a discussion. In any case, they reach an agreement that the land would be sold to non-Jews, but they also said an additional stricture, only non-Jews are allowed to work on the land, and Jews could only perform agricultural labors that are forbidden rabbinically. In other words, there's a debate as to what, like you can't, to plant, to prune, to harvest, and to pick fruit, those are Torah prohibitions, but there are also rabbinic prohibitions on Shemitah. So the truth is, even though Rav Yitzchak Inspector said that we had this heter mechira, that you can sell the land to the non-Jews and they can work on the land, but I'm not going to go so far as to allow Jews to work on the land or to work on the land in things that are Torah violations. So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Sfechter issues his historic decision. He says, the truth is when he actually, so that they reached an agreement, and then he actually became even more stringent. And he reached his historic decision was, you could sell the land to non-Jews, but no Jews are not allowed to work the land at all. They can't do rabbinically things that are rabbinically or Torah prohibited. But essentially, again, you sell the land, non-Jews can work on it, but now they can earn a living. The Sephardic rabbis of Israel, headed by Rav Yaakov Shol El Yashar, supported the heter. Rav Yoshua Kutno felt that the sale of land is similar to Pesach, right? He said, what do we do on Pesach? You know, we have all this, what is it, whiskey? I don't know, whatever it is. Okay, we have all this whiskey, and all beer, whatever, I don't know. Whatever people have with it. You know, it's hard to get rid of, someone has a store with a lot of beer, so how do you do that? So there, what do you do? For all Pesach, you sell your chavet, you buy it back after. So it's similar to this as well. And so, yeah.
Right.
So, right. So you can work on. So you can. So I guess you would sell the land. I think you can work on it really any kind of way that you want. In other words, you're selling the land, and basically you probably could tie into the price. You know what the expected profits are going to be. You're simply not owning the land. Whatever. I'm not exactly sure exactly like what the terms are. It's probably different now than it was then. But I think the point is simply they own it, and you can work out whatever deal you want in terms of that. I don't think this has to be some kind of mechanism. It has to be a real sale that you have no rights to this land for that year. There was a whole discussion whether it has to be a sale for 1 year or 2 years even, because there's actually a prohibition of 30 days before Shemitah, not to work on the land also. So the question is a one-year sale or a two-year sale. But I'm not sure of the specifics, but essentially I think you can work on however you want because you don't own the land. So essentially, it's... Yeah.
Same question with Pesach, but here, is there not a worry that you may not want to sell the land back to you?
Right. So you have to make it advantageous. So when it comes to the chametz, you say for the chametz, I tell you what you do for the chametz. So when I sell the chametz to the non-Jew, I actually sell it for the full amount. There's whatever the fair market value of all the chametz is.
Right.
So the truth, if they do want to pay for the full amount, then they can. They can buy all our chametz. But I'm not just saying, they're not buying it for like pennies on the dollar. They're paying for the full amount. So they're not going to want to do that. You can put in whatever kind of provision you want to make it. You can do that. You can make a provision. Yeah,
they don't actually pay. I mean, if you sell the chametz,
they do pay. They pay for chametz. They pay. They give a down payment and they write an IOU for the rest.
Well,
it's legally binding. Yeah.
They don't pay.
No. We have a document. At least the way I do it, they have a document. So it's not. By the way, so it's not so clear. It's not so clear why Baron Rothschild had a change of heart. In the book, I did a lot of reading of this book, Rebels of the Holy Land, where I read a lot about this topic. And so in this book, it states that some historians conjecture that Rothschild had no change of heart at all. Remember, he first went to Shmuel Salon in March and April, and he said no, and then in October he went back. So did he simply realize, oh my gosh, it's not going to work? So he said some historians conjecture that he had no change of heart at all, that there had been a simple misunderstanding. When the Baron visited Rabbi Salant in Jerusalem, the two men spoke via an interpreter. The Rabbi spoke in Yiddish, which was translated into French for the Baron. It is possible that something got lost in the translation as the Baron, overwhelmed by the experience, politely nodded without grasping the full implications of the Rabbi's words. So it's not exactly clear whether the Baron fully understood, whether he had a change of heart, or really he was just trying to be polite. Now, some from the old Yishuv believe that Rothschild was tricked by the anti-religious administrators of the settlements. In any case, Baron Rothschild became a staunch advocate of the farmers working during Shemitah. He very much wanted them all to rely on the Heter Mechira, because this is his investment, this is his pride and joy, and he didn't want it to fail. So he decreed, he said the farmers must rely on the Heter Mechira, and his standing, and once he did that, Baron Rothschild was really this benevolent, macher, who look what he's doing, he's supporting Jews coming to live in Eretz Yisrael. Once he made this ruling, so then his reputation, his standing was tarnished in the Jewish press because not everyone agreed with Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector's ruling. Rav Salant, when he heard about this, he wrote that Shemitah should be observed, and he wrote, quote, "The Jewish farmers already observed Shemitah in 1881 to 1882 in Petach Tikva, and they did not seek out legal devices to be exempt from it. There is no limit to what God can do to bring about salvation." So Shmuel Salant did not, he wasn't going to agree to this. Eliezer ben Yehuda, interesting, right? Is he a religious person?
No.
He's not a religious person. In 1882, remember, he came before the Shemitah of 1882. In 1882, he supported the observance of Shemitah. Why? Because he thought that there weren't so many settlements, and he actually thought that this will lead to the ultra-Orthodox to support nationalism. But in 1889, he strongly urged his readers to support the Heter Mechira. He eventually called Rav Salant the enemy of the new Yishuv, because, and this is a picture of him, by the way, this is Eliezer ben Yehuda's picture, and then basically an editor of the leading old Yishuv newspaper accused ben Yehuda of being a phony, and he writes here in Hebrew, he writes here, Vehinini, Morim es kvod rabbinim hagonim lasim libam lahamamar dvar shmita mikavod hagaon mufursam Rav Yaakov Mordechai Hirston. This is another rabbi that apparently wrote about this that Ben Yehuda told people to follow. Vanachnu mekavim, and I hope ki kavod harabbinim hagonim b'chutz laaretz, that we hope that because of the honor of the rabbis in Chutzlar, Asher Kol Beis Yisrael Nisham Aleihem, that everyone's relying on them, Asher Leib Lahem, Lavin et Erech HaShilah Zot Yisrael, Lo Yimaru Kol Kach Lerot Koach Haisur, that the rabbis outside Israel shouldn't just run to say it's forbidden, Terem Yishkulos HaDavar Heitev Heitev, Terem Yivchanu Mikol Tzad. He said they shouldn't simply just sit before they evaluate it. Sheila Gedola Ta Lifnei Rabbanim. This is a major question for the rabbi. Sheila Asher, who like Kol Tikva Yisrael Tuliyabo. This is a question where the whole hope of Klal Yisrael depends on. Ubtilchim Anafti Bechachmatam Bechibotam He said, again, this is Eliezer ben Yehuda, who's a second, he's a secular Jew. But he's saying, because he understands the importance of this, and he says that the rabbi shouldn't just say, oh, it's forbidden, without taking, this is obviously a very serious issue, and he became like public enemy number one against the Yeshuva Yashan, because he was calling them like they don't understand, they're going to ruin the whole Yeshuva, and he was a major advocate for the Heter Bechira. Again, he wasn't a religious person, but he felt very strongly about this. Yeah, Howie? Right, so... Yeah. So I'm gonna, let me. Hold, it's a great point. Let me hold off because we're going to see. So this is an interesting question. The crux of my talk here. The real issue is which rabbis held for the Bechira, for or against this heter? Was it like the Zionists who were for it and the anti-Zionists who were against it? Did it change depending on the year? We're going to see that some of these rabbis changed their mind, and we're going to see the reason about it. So let's hold that thought for a bit. It's a great question.
If they sold it, the Jews would not allow to work on it.
Again, so what I'm saying is they were overly strict. You could argue. Rav Yitzchak Hanan Spector's allowance was only that if you sold it, then they can non-Jews can work on the land and they can sell it and people can eat it without a problem and they can earn the profits. What I'm saying, you could still make a halachic argument saying that once you sell it to the non-Jew, therefore, it has no holiness of Shemitah. Therefore, even Jews can work the land. This is a debated halachic point, which I'm not going to go into. But that's why I sort of made the comment before, that there are really two different issues. Number one is, are you allowed to work the land? And number two is, what's the status of the fruit? So in other words, what it seems is that Rav Yitzchak Hanan Spector, when he allowed it, he was allowing the least possible to maintain so that the settlements don't collapse.
Well, the reason I say if they were not allowed to work on it, right. I could see where the owners of the farm could rent it and have some sort of an income.
Right.
But if you had Jewish farm workers that didn't own the land, they would really be unemployed for a year.
I understand. So they're quite right. So that's right. Could they do something else? So these are interesting questions, right? And this is, could they get other jobs? What kind of jobs could they get? Okay. So in any case, different settlements had, so what did the settlements do in the end of the day? So different settlements had different positions about relying on the Heter Mechira, and even within individual settlements, there were different positions. For example, in Petach Tikva, half relied on the Heter Mechira and half didn't. Most farmers as a whole, relied on the Heter, especially after the chief benefactor, Baron Rothschild, put a little pressure on them. In October of 1888, and I apologize, I'm going to read it to you because it didn't come out so well, but 30 of the most prominent Ashkenazic rabbis of Jerusalem issued a proclamation on the other side called, you see, look, Kol Mehechal, a call from the palace. It was a call to arms to defend the traditional way of life and appealed to Jews from around the world to contribute funds to support the farmers who valiantly observe the Shemitah. So what I'm going to read to you is a little bit this on the bottom, on the left-hand side, which is very unclear. And I apologize. So let me just read it to you what it says here. This excerpt here. This is the copy here. It's like from this book here. So this you see over here. It's signed by 30 rabbis. And here's just an excerpt. The Shemitah year has arrived, and our brothers, the colonists, who tremble with all their might at the word of God, have accepted upon themselves the prohibition that was issued by the Jerusalem rabbinate, Again, the Jerusalem Rabbinate said you should not rely on the Heter Mechira, which forbids the colonists to engage in any kind of work in the field that is prohibited during Shemitah with no leniencies whatsoever. The wise man taught us that for a piece of bread, a man will sin, and must therefore be concerned about the future. The idea of farming the land of Israel is caught on amongst our people. Many colonies have established, consisting over 2,000 people, but their welfare is in the hands of the administration that was set up over them. In the event of the administrators persuade the benefactor to cease funding those who will not work in the sabbatical year. Notice what he's doing. He's not blaming Baron Rothschild. You don't blame this really wealthy benefactor, okay? You blame the anti-religious administrators, okay? So he says, because what he said, we're not going to fund. You know, we're not going to give funding. We're not going to. You don't rely on Heter Mechira. We're not funding the settlements. So he says, therefore, we must be concerned lest the colonists violate the laws of the Torah. As a result of the hunger, they and their children are liable to suffer. For most of these people are very poor, with only their shirts on their backs. All they are asking is to remove the specter of the humiliation of hunger, to give them enough bread to eat for this year, so that they can remain steadfast in allegiance to God and His Torah. We call upon the rabbis to wake up and convene assemblies in order to motivate people to support this great mitzvah. Please send all contributions for your 501c3 to our leaders, Rabbi Yoshua Leib Diskin and Rav Shmuel Salant, who will give the funds to a select committee that will then distribute the donations to the colonists. Don't pay heed to the newspapers that cynically, the newspapers, of course, are run by Ben Yehuda, that cynically disparage everything that is sacred. Amongst their writers are people who denigrate the Torah and its scholars, people who desecrate the Shabbos in secret as well as in public. And if the sanctity of the Shabbos is like a joke in the eyes of these fools, so much more so of a whole year of Shemitah. Now, many rabbis, they tried to arrange to send funds in. One rabbi who was alive at the time, some of you are familiar with him, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, okay, so he issued a proclamation in December of 1888 affirming support for Shemitah observance. He was not in favor of the Heter Mechira. And he appealed for Jews to contribute to the financial welfare of the farmers. In other words, collect funds so these people could observe Shemitah. However, not enough money came for those settlements like Ekron. In Ekron, the farmers all refused to work during the Shemitah year. Most of this book is about what happens in Ekron. So this obviously creates a lot of tension. Because of how you view these people. Do you view them as lazy farmers, or do you view them as God-fearing individuals and supporters and opponents hailed insults upon against each other? Other rabbis, now this is important, it's going back to Howie's point. You know, you're saying about, you know, what was it simply the people who were against, you know, the settlement of the land? So in this first major debate, it wasn't necessarily split upon ideological lines. As an example, the Netziv of Volozhin and the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Levi Soloveitchik, the great-grandfather of the Rav, both opposed the Heter Mechira. The Netziv was a big proponent of, they may not have been aware of the conditions, but they were opponent of the Heter Mechira. One second. It should be noted, like as I mentioned, the Netziv was a big supporter of Chovei Tzion, and even though he opposed the Heter Mechira, other opponents included the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chaim Michael Epstein, yeah? Okay.
That in their world, it wasn't that we forced them, because it wasn't like they weren't in protection, they didn't work for them, they lived in Jerusalem, get supported by charity. It wasn't something that they skewed as a priority.
Right, so that, connection to it. Right, so I'm telling you, so the Netziv, for example, was an individual. He himself was a big supporter of the Chovei Tzion movement. Again, he wasn't there, but he's an example of someone who was very supportive of these agricultural settlements and supporting the land to make sure they succeed, yet he was opposed to the Heter Mechira. So now we fast forward 7 years. Okay, we fast forward 7 years. It's 1895, 1896. And this time, Rav Naftali Hertz, the chief rabbi of Yafo, it lobbies the great rabbis of Yerushalayim to support the Heter Mechira. And who are the rabbis at the time in Yerushalayim? Rav Shmuel Salant and Yoshua Leib Diskin. And both of them approve the Heter Mechira. Okay? They have some technical changes at the Mechira. They want to sell the trees. This is a halakha issue. They'd rather sell the trees with the soil permanently rather than temporarily sell the land. Okay, these are halachic technical issue. They're dealing with some of these issues. But the question is, why did they change? Why did they fundamentally change their position? It's been suggested that initially these rabbanim felt that since we had now merited returning to Eretz Yisrael, we want to observe all the laws without compromise. However, upon realizing that very few farmers actually observed Shemitah properly, the feeling was that without the option of the Heter Mechira, most farmers would ignore Shemitah completely. So in other words, do you rely on the Heter Mechira, which is not necessarily so great? Or do you say that you go for the gold standard? But if it means, if we're saying we're opposed to that, we're going to ignore it completely. So they felt this second go-round better permit the Heter Mechira while encouraging farmers not to rely on it. Okay? They say better not to rely on it. Okay? So 7 years later, in 1902, 1903, Rav Yishuv Leib Diskin passed away, and the leadership of the old Yishuv passed to the Aderet. Rav Leol David Rabinovitz Ta'omim, the father-in-law of Rav Kook, and he supports Heter Mechira again, reluctantly. Rav Kook enters the scene in 1909, 1910, Shemitah year. He was a new rabbi of Yafo, before we get into that, I just wanted this last piece here on the handout, before we move on to Rav Kook, this is just an example of, Rav Yitzchak Inspector got a lot of grief from his leniency. This is an example here. This is a letter that he writes to Rav Molivar, who is a big, you know, Zionist, religious Zionist. He says, I received a letter from Rabbi Shmuel Salant, who writes that Dr. Goldberg, an emissary of the benefactor from Paris, arrived in Jerusalem with the task of creating a bill of sale for Shemitah purposes in the Jerusalem Basin. Rav Salant wrote that he does not concur, he disagrees, because any bill of sale that is not executed in the Ottoman court is not legally binding. And I responded that the bill is binding, even if done in the Basin. He wants to say that this is a phony sale. And I think it is valid. Shortly thereafter, I received letters from all the rabbis of Kol HaPerushim and of the Beit Din there. 17 signatories in all, howling and railing against my head there regarding Shemitah, admonishing and telling me that there exists no danger to life or the state of emergency whatsoever. On the contrary, he writes to Rav Molivar, observing the Shemitah benefits the land and its inhabitants, the rabbis communicate in their typically verbose and rancorous manner, and he writes, and I didn't respond to them at all. So he's like, you can imagine, like this was like a lot of fighting going on to Yitzchak Inspector, the Gadol HaDor, to try to get him to change his mind, and at some point he's like, I'm not responding to them. But in any case, point being, the first Heter Mechira in 1888 to 1889, some of the original opponents of Shmuel Salant and Yishuv Leib Diskin changed their view 7 years later. We move now to 1909, 1910, Rav Kook. Now at this stage, the second Aliyah is underway. And many new agricultural settlements were almost entirely non-religious. Most of these farmers are willing to cooperate with the rabbis on issues concerning Shabbos, Orla, means you can't use the tree for 3 years, and also separating Trumos and Masros, but it was impossible to tell them not to work on your fields for a full year. The distancing of the pioneers from Torah observance, it had a dual effect. Because now that it's becoming clear that many of the founders of this new Zionist movement are really anti-religious, really secular, we're going to compromise on some issues. So now the dispute becomes ideological. Now the opponents of the Heter escalated their struggle against it. And the rabbis who supported it. But on the other hand, it strengthened the position of those in favor, because they wanted in other words, people like Rav Kook wanted these farmers to continue to cooperate with them in matters of kashrus. Why should a secular Jew care about like kashrus, religion? So Rav Kook is saying, instead of railing on them, let's find a way to make it permissible. Even though I'm not excited about this, Rav Kook in his writings talks about a lot about when we're creating a new state, it has to be at like the highest level in a number of matters. But here he's saying we have to keep these the non-religious in the fold. As opposed to others who would say, you see what this new movement is becoming? We have to be completely against it. It becomes, in Rav Kook's time, it becomes almost completely ideological. In 1909, the Ritvaz, who is the, as I mentioned, of Yaakov David Wolofsky, who's the chief rabbi of Tzfat, he turns to Rav Kook with a proposal to visit Baron Rothschild and convince him to support total observance of Shemitah without reliance on the Heter Mechira. And Rav Kook refused, and he insisted that his first priority is to support the Heter Bechira. You should know, when Rav Kook, this may get back to your point, get out, when Rav Kook was originally in Europe, he was not in favor of the Heter Bechira. But now he sees what's going on, and he says, we should create a Heter Mechira, allow the selling of the land so people can work on the fields and sell the fruit. But at the same time, I do want to assist farmers who don't want to rely on it. It should be noted, as I mentioned, Rav Kook and his father-in-law initially opposed the Heter while in Europe, but they changed their mind upon arriving in Eretz Yisrael and taking note of the dire circumstances there. The old Yishuv rabbis totally opposed and boycotted the Heter this time, and a major battle develops with the workers of the new Yishuv who rally behind Rav Kook, and they called the old Yishuv rabbis cruel for preferring the produce of Arabs over the success of the Jewish farmers. Both the Ritvaz and Rav Kook wrote Sfarim to back up their halachic positions, the Pa'at HaShulchan by the Ritvaz and Shabbat Ha'aretz by Rav Kook. By this time, as I mentioned, the ideological camps were evident. If initially there were rabbis who supported Chovei Tzion but objected to the Heter, like the Netziv, in the second generation, all those who supported the new settlements also approved of the Heter Bechira. Conversely, the defining characteristic of the opponents was their reservations to one extent or another of the Yeshuva Chadash, this new settlement, and certainly their disapproval of the Zionist movement, which in the meantime had been founded in 1897, and most of its leaders and activists were non-observant. Rav Eliezer Melamed, he is one of the leading religious Zionist rabbis in Israel today. He explains that only in this light can the fierce opposition to the Heter be understood. This was fierce. In the first generation, see, the first generation of rabbis who opposed the Heter Bechira, they were able to disregard the lenient view. Why? Because this is a new matter. It hadn't been clarified. And to be honest, the extent of the distress to the farmers was not clear. In 1889, it wasn't so clear. It was new. People were saying, okay, the settlements are going to collapse. And the rabbis in Yerushalayim thought, maybe if from the outside they give enough money, things will be okay. The facts weren't so clear. So it was easier not to rely on, in a sense, it was easier, before you're aware of how dire the circumstances were, is easier to sort of reject the Heter Bechira, to say, because the debate is simply, how necessary is it? But in the second generation, the opponents of the Heter Bechira were already familiar with how dire the consequences were, and they know, like, you know, there's something, they know that the arguments to be lenient are very strong. And Rav Melamed writes, and he doesn't need my agreement to this, I do agree with what he's saying, that, you know, there's another major leniency that the rabbis came up with years before this, called Chadash and Yasha, right? So if you look, the simple reading of the Torah is that grain, you know, new grain cannot be consumed. Grain that takes root, let's say after Pesach, and then it grows, let's say in the summertime, you're not allowed to eat it until the following Pesach. So I would imagine that most of us, if not all of us in this room, aren't stringent in this. Now, this is an example where the simple reading of the Torah seems to say that we should be stringent. However, this was the rabbis engaged in, sometimes the rabbis, some people think, may engage in gymnastics to be strict. This is an example where the opposite happened. They engage in academic gymnastics to find a way to be lenient because of the dire situation. So the point, Rav Melamed argues, that those supporting the Heter Mechira had a lot more to rely on, much firmer basis to rely on, than the leniency to eat chadash, quote-unquote, new grain. But and so therefore he believes that, again, that by 1909, most of the opponents of the Heter were against the Zionist movement as a whole and anything associated with it. Rav Kook, back to Heter, as formulated by Rav Yisrael Chanan Spector for the most part, he was also keen to stress that this was a temporary measure to be readdressed every Shemitah. It's not my topic for today, but his point being is to make the argument that because Rav Kook supported it, you know, 100 years ago, so therefore we can definitely support it now. His point was, he always said this is a temporary measure. We could still be in a temporary measure nowadays, but he's making halachic arguments to be lenient combined with the dire situation which we find ourselves, that we have to continue to evaluate that. He also supported and raised money for those farmers who did not wish to rely on the Heter Mechira, while insisting on the validity of the Heter. In this vein, he also suggested for the first time the introduction of an Otsar Beis Din, whereby produce would be collectively harvested by a Beit Din, and the individual farmers would have no private ownership. Basically, they're paid for a flat rate for the work and not for specific produce. Okay, this actually, some people rely on this nowadays. Used what's called the Otsar Beis Din. So not many people used it, essentially, when he came up with it. In the 1940s, the Chazon Ish revived that idea. Again, even with the Heter, Rav Kook only permitted work by non-Jews, or if necessary, by Jews in a manner that would be a rabbinic malacha, rabbinic prohibited work on Shemitah only. Rav Moliver actually allowed a more permissive Heter, but Rav Kook was a little more strict. And Rav Kook draws very heavy criticism from both sides. The old Yishuv accuses him of siding with the non-religious settlements of the settlers of the new Yishuv. Those same settlers accused Rav Kook of being too strict and not allowing them to work the Shemitah, because they could also point to other rabbis like Rav Moliver, who felt that if you sell the land to a non-Jew, then even Jews could work. So Rav Kook's trying to straddle the fence, and he gets attacked by both sides. But I guess the view is, if you're attacked by both sides, that means you're doing something right. Okay, so in sum, the Heter Mechira is a fascinating mix of halacha, extenuating circumstances, concerned whether halacha will be followed, and one's religious view about the Zionist enterprise. There clearly are sound reasons to be lenient if necessary, and it seems that in the beginning, in 1888 to 1889, the debate may have been not only about halacha, but really about the necessity of the Heter. As Rav Shmuel Salant and Yisrael Leib Diskin may have felt that the farmers would be able to handle a year off with enough support for the broader community, and even Zionist rabbis, like the Netziv, oppose the Heter Mechira. It had nothing to do with Hashkafa at this point. When they realized how desperate the situation was in the next Shemitah cycle in 1895-1896, and they realized that the secular farmers would not likely listen to the rabbis about Shemitah, they may have decided to sanction a less than ideal situation so that the farmers would observe halacha based on Yitzchak Chanan Spector's ruling. By the time that Rav Kook enters the scene, the battle lines seem to be drawn according to one's view of Zionism. Rav Kook backed the Heter Mechira, and he was a strong supporter of Zionism, while those opposed to Zionism viewed the Heter as part of the entire Zionist secular enterprise, something that they could not support. Perhaps another way to look at the debate is whether Shemitah observance undermines the settling of the land. Because why? What's the whole purpose why we settle the land? Is to observe mitzvot like Shemitah. Or do you believe that there's a value to settling the land irrespective of observing the mitzvot of the land? So a Heter Mechira that would allow this is a good thing. And the same issues that were raised over 100 years ago are still issues today. Halachic, hashkafic, and whether we find ourselves in extenuating circumstances. So the heter bechira issue is one of the many religious issues about which consensus has not been achieved in the state of Israel, and hopefully now we will have a better appreciation of the history surrounding this debate.